Now, folks, it's time for us to start having a chat with our guest today.
Mike.
From Raglan Chocolate. G'day, Mike.
G'day, Craig. How are you, mate?
You have to get a bit closer than that, Mike.
Get a bit closer.
Get comfortable. Pull it up to your face a little bit.
All right. Got it.
Talk like that. All right. Sweet. And we've just been chatting away in the studio about various things, but what we want to talk about, I guess, firstly is we had a chat the other day, and you were telling me a fascinating sort of history about cacao and Papua New Guinea especially. And that's where you source, most of your cacao for your chocolate?
That's right. Yeah, we source exclusively from the Pacific now.
Mm-hmm.
Papua New Guinea is a really, really important one for us. Cacao is traditionally grown in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And a question that often comes up is how did it get to be in the Pacific?
Yeah.
And it is, for me, it's a fascinating story. Absolutely fascinating.
Pray tell, Mike, pray tell.
So it goes back, my understanding is, and I'm no historian, but just curious, it goes back probably 1880s and plus or minus 20 years. There were numerous different individuals and organizations, maybe even, who were interested in either propagating commercial crops, or they were horticulturalists, so they were genuinely interested in taking crops around the world and showing them off and trying them out. So cacao was one that was discovered in Central America.
Hmm.
And it was taken about that time over to the islands. I'm not sure which islands, but over to the islands in the Pacific. And to Singapore, it was certainly established in the Botanic Garden in Singapore, and as a result, there was practically a library of cacao over there, and there still is now, with a lot of different genetic material, and it is quite, in fact, it's incredibly diverse in cacao, and so over the decades since, as there's been interest in cacao for various reasons. More and more of this genetic stock has been tapped into from Singapore and taken back into the islands. So I think you can look at Samoa, Vanuatu, Solomon, and PNG as all being substantial producers, and most of that stock is either from Singapore or highly influenced from Singapore.
Interesting,
obviously through. From Central America.
Yeah. And it's very old, eh? It was used the Aztec or the Mayan days? Mayan days, I think it was, wasn't it, when it was first kind of used in, ceremonies and things like that?
It was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you whether it was one other or the both,
yeah.
But they actually used it as currency at one point. Bean was currency.
Mm-hmm.
Another anecdote would be that Moctezuma, who was the emperor? I don't know.
I know who you mean. Yeah. Neil Young did a great song about Montezuma as well. Yes.
So he was reputed to drink 20 or 30 cups of cocoa a day for his libido and other things.
Right on. Yeah.
So hence I'm trying.
Yes. We just sampled some of your beautiful cacao just now. Your special little brew you do for yourself. Look after yourself, Mike.
That's right.
Are you going to give away the little secrets on the brew, are you?
I can only suggest that if anyone wants an alternative pick-me-up to coffee, something that's not as strong, but definitely picks you up, but you get a far longer-lasting, more happy buzz... is to drink a cacao drink. So that would be something that's made with some 100% cacao paste and boiled up in some water and maybe add a little bit of sweetener or a little bit of oat milk or something. And that is a drink a couple of times a day. It can be a hell of a pick-me-up. It doesn't come with the negatives of coffee, where it can deplete your vitamins and minerals in your body and also leave you with that crash. So I really do recommend it. Great for your mental health too, as it's such a positive pick me up.
I wonder. This is a bit of an aside, but you know how there always used to be tea rooms around the place, right? Now it's all cafes, right? Selling coffee. Is that the next big thing? Cacao.
Well, an interesting part of the history that I forgot to pass on to you with my little history lesson earlier was that part of the reason there was so much interest in cacao being transferred around the world at that time is that cacao was the coffee as we know it today. In the 1800s, it was cocoa shops, cocoa cafes in Europe.
Huh.
And they were as common as our barista-made coffee shops are today.
Huh. Yeah. So damn, it's already been done.
Yeah. It's such a shame that it died away.
Yeah.
But well, it was a big thing going down to the coffee shop and sitting there with your little little cocoa.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a lot better for you, like you point out, right? Mm. And isn't there problems with coffee beans being produced or something? Do I hear or read something about that?
Look, I'm a bit of a skeptic about some of these rumours because there's the same sort of rumour in cocoa, cacao. Basically, it is, I think it's misinformation designed to manipulate the commodity price of these things. People go, oh, it's Easter and the price of chocolate's going up because there's a world shortage.
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably not the case. Yeah.
Someone like, you know, the big international producers seem to want to create that effect in the commodity world.
All right. So getting back to PNG then, you've been over there. Well, I guess when did you start getting your cacao from, like, over there, would you say? Straight away when you started up the chocolate, would you say 7 years ago you started making chocolate or something like that?
Yeah, about 7 years ago. No, actually, we were the craft chocolate industry is in New Zealand has moved quite quickly. 7 years ago, you couldn't buy in New Zealand. You couldn't buy any cacao from the Pacific. Very little was being bought in.
I presume it would have been still being grown though, right?
It was being grown, absolutely. Yeah. But the only thing that was being bought in was the trade aid were bringing in Ecuadorian and Peruvian and Dominican Republic beans, which was fantastic. So as a fledgling chocolate maker, and many of us started this way, was to buy beans from trade aid. As we've gone on, we've decided that buying more locally, buying in the Pacific, is what we want to do. We want to support the Pacific because, generally speaking, the communities that are growing it are subsistence communities. They are not wealthy. They're trying to make money. They're trying to make a living off their land. And so if we can support those closest to us, that's the Pacific, that's what we want to do. PNG is not the first of the Pacific chocolates I got hold of. I started using Solomon Island chocolate, which is incredibly fruity and punchy, and it's all about these flavors. So you want to get different origins so you can get different flavors. And then I was able to source Vanuatu, and Vanuatu is very soft and caramelly, which is just a beautiful eating chocolate. Mm-hmm. And then it was most recently, about 3 or 4 years ago now, I managed to get hold of some PNG, and it is a complex mix of the other two, plus stronger and more interesting and minerally flavors and influences of the jungle and the volcanic soil. You know, if you get there on the land, you can pick up all these aromas and you can feel them and see them and smell and taste them coming through in the chocolate.
So, tell us about the land of PNG, Mike. You've been over there a few times there.
A couple of times last year. Very lucky, and I think I'm going again in July. Mm-hmm. So very much for volcanic. Mountainous country with huge rivers. It's an incredible country. The flat land, the cropping land, is really, really around the coast. So most of the coastal regions do have some history of growing cacao. Because as I intimated earlier, when when there's demand for cocoa and there's a high interest in cocoa, the price is up. There's interest around the world in cropping more cocoa or cacao.
Yeah.
And so this has happened in waves over the last 150 years, that the price is up, masses of energy goes into expanding the growing, the planting, the cropping, the estates of cocoa. But then, unfortunately, as the commodity price goes down, this the interest in buying from smaller croppers, like in the islands, dies off, and the big players in the market will just continue to buy from West Africa, yeah, which is who's the biggest producer in the world.
West Africa is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the history in the Pacific in particular is of boom and bust. So you'd have families and communities with land planting acres and acres of cacao trees, and then 10 years later, after getting maybe 5 years cropping out of them, the commodity price has dropped to such a point that there's no use in them farming it. So the crops are left to go revert to forest.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of thing is happening on a cycle. I can only guess whether this cycle is 20 years or 30 years or what it is. But either way, there's been several cycles in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there in PNG, there are crops that are overgrown, intermingled with gum plantations, which are also a similar crop.
Gum?
Yeah.
Okay.
With other forest types and just jungle.
Yeah.
That are sitting there. They've been planted in the past. They've been cropped in the past. Been sold in the international market, and then the interest has died away because the price has gone down so low.
And untended, do they survive in the jungle?
They do survive quite well. They like a shade canopy, so they're quite happy to have larger trees grow through and shade them out.
Mm.
They, interestingly enough, they can handle wet feet. Up in East Sepik, which is one of the regions we're getting some of our beans from, the East Sepik River is enormous. It's like the Waikato River, except in the dry season it's half the size of the Waikato River, but in the wet season it's a kilometre and a half wide.
Far out.
So the flooding area either side of the river is incredibly rich from all the silt and everything that's brought down from the mountains.
Yeah,
so every year, I'm told about 100 millimetres of silt is added to the soil layer. And this is where a lot of the cacao is grown in that region, in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah,
and because it has a slightly different growing region, environment, mineral assortment in the soil,
yeah,
the beans have a slightly different taste. They are a very, very mellow version of the Papua New Guinea rich mineral character. So I love them very much.
Mm.
But the incredible thing is that the trees can be half underwater. They can have a meter of water over their roots, so that the cacao is actually being harvested in a boat.
Yeah.
So these guys, Sperian is the leader of a community that we go and work with out there, and he's leading the community into expanding the amount of cacao that they can pull out of that area, because it's a great crop from them, and it's just a matter of regenerating it.
Yeah,
revitalizing it. And so they paddle around in these boats with shears, and they're picking these pods. You know, it's like small rugby spot, multicolored, small rugby ball shaped pods.
And how big do the trees get?
The trees would go 3 or 4 meters.
Okay, yeah.
So they're reaching up to these trees and dropping them down into the boat, then rowing back to the area where they're processing them.
Yeah.
And so it's totally unique in the world.
Right on.
Yeah. Whereas the other forests down, say, in the south, close to Port Moresby, Abu District, we've got a couple of farmers that we're working with down there.
Mm.
And these guys are just an absolute inspiration. As we try to source more cacao, for Raglan Chocolate, but also for the other business, Weave Cacao, which is a which is a bigger business that we're part of creating solely to increase the volume that we're buying out of the Pacific so that the farmers in these regions are getting more return. Mm. So what was my thread?
Different soil types for that.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of farming communities down in the Abu district, and these are intermingled, like I said, with rubber trees. So you'll drive down think of it as a four-wheel drive track, and there'll be rows and rows of rubber trees going off to the left and right. And these might have been planted 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And currently the commodity price for rubber is low, so they haven't been harvested in 10 years.
Mm.
And the commodity price for cacao's coming up. So they've started over the last couple of years planting cacao down each row. So we've got these these incredibly intermingled and complex systems where cacao's growing. It's absolutely fascinating.
Trippy, yeah. I suppose the soil would be, you know, like you say, quite different between, like, was it East Sepik, where you're talking about? And because I presume these areas by Port Moresby and that wouldn't be flooded so much?
Not so much flooding, definitely. Yeah. But I think they are being affected by the weather, the changing weather, the climate-related changes with more extreme rains and unseasonal flooding. Another reason we need to have multiple different sources for the cacao is that there are droughts, and so some of the farming regions there's almost no production at all from drought, and then there can be flooding. So in the Abu district there was flooding last year, which meant there was very, very little cacao coming out of there. And 12 months earlier, it was drought in that same region. So we haven't had much cacao out of the Abu district.
Mm.
But we've been fortunate with the East Sepik district. They haven't been affected in the same way.
Wow. Must be tough on the farmers trying to live like that, man.
It's incredible. It's incredibly tough.
Yeah.
Subsistence living.
Yeah.
It really is.
So what, they stay in like huts and that sort of thing? Yep. They have bamboo over there?
Bamboo, absolutely. Yeah. Bamboo and palms and that. So, you know, all the palm mats are woven to create roofs and floors. Basically, it's bamboo. And up in East Sepik, they sit up on poles so that when the water floods, they sit up above the water.
Yeah.
We're lucky enough to stay a night.
Like a cool treehouse or something.
And this great big tree hat. I mean, yeah, we go up there as the white fella and we're treated like gods. This family, they evacuated their house for us so that, I don't know, there were 10 of us went up the river.
Yeah.
And basically they gave us their whole house.
That's good hosting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I got a room shared with another guy who snored like a train. But that's okay. but the walls are only a single layer of woven bamboo thick, so it might have been the guy through the other room. And your mat, your floor is a bamboo frame, and the floor is a woven mat. Mm. And then for us soft white fellas, we had like a yoga mat that was 5 mil thick, and that was our bed, and a kid's duvet to throw over us.
Yeah.
That was them putting it on for the white fellas because they felt that we were soft and we needed it.
And you probably did.
Oh, and a mozzie net, of course. We're so very, very lucky to be there. It was just the most superb situation.
Yeah, all right.
And so, I guess the
tropical forests in that there, they'd be like super old and like massively high and everything like that?
Yes, a real mixture. Yeah. The best view of the forest we got, well, several. If you fly over the forests, it's just all a massive green. You don't really get a good picture. Mm. But you see these incredible rivers that look like anaconda.
Yeah.
Just sweeping back and forward. They are the most amazing thing.
Okay.
To get up to East Sepik, we had to travel up the river. So from Port Moresby, it was a two-hour flight to Weewak, is another town. Then it was a five-hour four-wheel drive track drive in a Land Cruiser, and then a two-hour boat ride in a fiberglass canoe with an outboard on the back, with guys armed with machine guns and stuff, because apparently we needed to be protected.
What is it, like river pirates or something like that? Or?
Apparently. I think there may be up there, but we certainly didn't see anything. But it was an interesting thing. But we're heading up the jungle, up through the jungle there. That's where you get a great view. There are areas that have been cleared and planted with palm oil palm, which is absolutely horrific.
Yes,
it's a monocrop that dominates and completely destroys anything else that can grow there.
As much as they can on deforestation, or?
There is quite a lot. It's alarming. There's not the level of controls that we have in New Zealand to stop that sort of thing, and there's plenty of dodgy dealing and kickbacks, and then there's just complete fraud where someone will just march in and say, "This is mine," and they'll do that. Mostly the corporations providing the labor will be contract selling to one of the big internationals who we know. So it's a big multinational funding someone else who's less known to actually do the land clearing and then the plant the palm oil, and then it's the locals who harvest it. So you're driving along these four-wheel drive tracks, and there's these bunches of red berries. If anyone's seen the Phoenix palms in the main road fruiting, you'll see that they have a bunch, and there's a whole lot of yellow fruit or whatever you call them. The palm is it's a red berry. It's a bigger bunch, and there are all these bunches sitting on the sides of the track, and they'll have a little piece of paper tied to them, and it'll have the whoever's picked it, it'll have his name on it. And then the guys who are picking it all up, they keep a tally on that, and it gets taken back to to some sort of processing plant close by where the pre-processing's done, where it's shipped off, probably shipped off to Europe.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen the very same thing in Borneo. I was over there, and man, just like some beautiful forests and K's and K's and K's of man, just floored for palm.
It was quite depressing to see. Yeah. There's also weed infestations. I know there was the weed busters were talking about a similar sort of thing, but you can go down a river in Papua New Guinea and you can see some of these big trees just getting completely covered in climbing creepers. It would be the same sort of thing. That too was quite shocking, and there would be introduced weeds through, because basically the river's like the highway. So anything near the highway will be affected.
I wonder if it's a similar one to what is it? Uncle Sam dropped over in Vietnam, didn't he, to tie up all the jungle and things like that? Might have escaped out of there and got around the place. Yeah.
Who knows? Oh, there's some incredible history, and I am interested in a little bit of the history around the Pacific, sort of post-war, being of the age that I am, with the colour hair I've got. There's the Takoda Trail that runs from the northern side of Papua New Guinea across to the south to Port Moresby, and this was the trail built by the Japanese. As they were taking over the Pacific, they'd taken some of the islands north of Papua New Guinea, and they were moving down with the intention of going traveling across Papua New Guinea into the capital, Port Moresby, where the harbour is. Then with that harbour, they were going to take Australia. So now it's a tourist trail, and when I've been up there, there've been busloads of Australian youth being taken over there. It's one of these things. Maybe the wayward youth, instead of sitting down with the family, or out here with the wise ones who can help them on their way, they're taken away for a life-changing experience. And in Australia, that's like, oh, take them to Papua New Guinea and make them walk the Takoda track. So there are remnants from the old war days there. Yeah.
I wonder if that works or not. I suppose it doesn't matter. But, well, something, I guess. Bit of an adventure, I suppose, with nothing else.
Yeah.
And what's New Zealand's involvement been in Papua New Guinea? So I know you were telling me a story, weren't you? Was it guns for rifles for rice or something?
Yes, that's right. What was that? It's one of the nice things about Papua New Guinea that I feel, and I feel it more about Papua New Guinea than, say, Solomon's or Vanuatu, it was because in the 1990s there was civil war in Papua New Guinea. And it was all about, well, basically you can trace it back to colonialization. But then in the 70s, the Australians who had taken over Papua New Guinea, governing Papua New Guinea post the war, they pulled out. I think basically they decided this is too hard. Because Papua New Guinea is challenging. It's divinely interesting and beautiful and inspiring, but it's also challenging. And I think the Australians found it just too hard, so they abandoned it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they had time to install their colonial mismanagement practices, and taught the new rulers of Papua New Guinea the same sort of thing. So you have mismanagement on a terrible scale with the likes of the palm oil, but you also have the mining up there. Uh-huh. And now part of Papua New Guinea, but also independent, is the island of Bougainville. So Bougainville is just off the north northwest coast of Papua New Guinea, and it has a huge mine. Decades and decades of iron mining and other mineral mining out of by Rio Tinto, they have just been extracting all the wealth out of that area for decades. And eventually, once the Australians pulled out of governing, the local people said, "Hang on a minute, those guys have gone. These guys are still taking all the wealth out of our country," and effectively a civil war developed from there.
Right. Yep.
So that's a roundabout way of saying, getting to, several different peacekeeping groups went through. Right. There was one, I think the French went in, and another one went in, and they entirely failed. Yeah. All they ended up doing was shooting each other, getting shot and shooting the locals.
Right.
And then,
doesn't sound too peaceful.
Yeah, didn't work very well. And then in the 1990s, a Kiwi Army contingent went in, and they went in, they had a look at it, and they went in with guitars instead of guns.
Guitars, that's right.
Yeah. There is a book on it, there's a movie on it, you'll be able to find out about it, and it's one of those things that, as Kiwis, we should be so proud about. That culture, it's us fellas sitting around playing a guitar and talking shit and looking out for each other, rather than just pointing the finger and saying you should do this and shoot that. So it's that element of our culture that was taken up there. And of course, there's a lot of Maori and Pacific Island guys in the military in New Zealand, and they took this up there, and it worked. And it worked so well that even now I've been up there and told, yeah, go to Bougainville. They love Kiwis over there. And there's this legacy from when the peacekeepers were up there. They love Kiwis up there.
That's
I haven't
cool.
been to Bougainville there, but I'm planning, I'll get up there within the next couple of years, because there is a lot of cacao growing up there.
Yeah.
So we need to get up there and trying to build some of these relationships, try and work with some of the people who are rehabilitating some of the cacao up there. We've got to make sure that it doesn't come from the region near the mine, because the pollution down there is terrible.
Oh,
and,
of course.
And if anyone's heard of some of the heavy metals in cacao from around the world, and that does happen, but generally it's because of mining pollution, although it is sometimes completely soil type driven.
So we'll
have an opportunity to get up there. Need to get up there.
Fantastic. It's a great story, isn't it? A little known but fascinating little part of New Zealand history there.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
just beautiful.
Guitars for guns. Nice.
Yeah.
I suppose we'd let you go, Mike. We've been chatting away for a while.
Yeah, just running out of time.
Is there anything you kind of want to finish on or inform the listeners about or anything like that?
A funny little addition. I think we sort of covered on it, but it didn't quite. I talked about how the prices go up and down in cacao.
Yes.
So this is a pet hate of mine. It's basically, it's driven by the commodity market, driven, supported by the big buyers. So that's Nestle, Mondelez, who owns Cadbury, Cargill.
These are all European?
These are all the European big cacao traders. Now, they between them, they are buying, Barry Callebaut is a fourth, they're buying about 80% of the world's cacao, and most of that is coming out of West Africa. So right. These are the guys who are telling you that they can't trace cacao, okay? Yeah. So they're telling you that because there is slavery and child labour and all those sort of things going on in the farms that they're sourcing from. So that's why they're telling you they can't trace it. Okay?
Yeah.
So there's that factor. The other fiddle that they're having is they are manipulating the message as it comes from cacao industry, that there's a shortage, that the price is high because of this reason or that reason. And the real reason is they're driving the price up or down for their own benefit, because they're speculating on the futures of cacao. Okay, so the price is being driven up, and yeah. It's being driven down. It's being driven up. And when the price is down, they're filling up warehouses, so they're buying the cacao at a very low price from the farmer.
Yeah.
And when the price is high, they're not buying from the farmer because the price is too high, and they're using stock from their warehouses. Okay, so they're controlling it and destroying the lives of the farmers.
That's a microcosm of a pretty sort of extractive, capitalist sort of multinational setup in a
And that's it. And that's
in a nutshell. Cacao nutshell.
Yeah. And so we started a little chocolate business, Raglan Chocolate, here, and because of the love of cacao and the desire to make beautiful chocolate and not fill it full of sugar. And this is what we've learned over the 7 years. And so that's why, with others, we've created Weave Cacao, with the idea of getting or creating a new paradigm in chocolate is really what we're saying. We'd like to be able to create a little ripple, so that those big guys, stand up and notice that we can do this. We can do it fairly. We can pay the farmers properly. We don't need. There's no slave labor. It's all grown organically. There's no need for any of that carry on. You know, you'll hear in. Oh, I'm ranting now. I'm going to stop ranting now.
The weave. So that's all chocolate makers.
Yeah. So we've got. There's a small group of five of us.
Yeah.
So
from New Zealand, or
all based here in New Zealand. Yeah, there's Una, who's a chocolatier and long term chocolate buyer from the Pacific. Mm. There's ourselves, Simone and I, as chocolate makers. There's we have a specialist in companies with a social good.
Oh yeah,
Social enterprise.
Social enterprise
accountant. Donna, we've got, and Tesh is our marketing guru. Mm. Tesh from here in Raglan.
Yeah.
And that's our little group, and we are trying to create the best possible model and prove that it can work, and feed back money to those farmers.
I can only wish you all strength on that one, Mike.
So let's end on that's the positive
one. That's a good positive one to end on, yeah. No, thanks very much, Mike. That was a fascinating little trip through some of the history of cacao and Papua New Guinea and things like that. Really interesting. Really enjoyed it. Thanks very much, Mike. Appreciate that.
Good one. Thank you.